You're about to hear an episode of Why Do We Do That? You can hear this podcast weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you're in the UK and you want to hear more, head over to BBC Sounds, where more episodes in the series are available.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Ella Al-Shamahi, a paleoanthropologist and explorer. Welcome to Why Do We Do That? An anthropologist's guide to the modern world. My cousin and her dog, Lucy, look alike. And boy, does she love Lucy. And by that, I mean that if my cousin had one spot on a lifeboat and she had to pick between me and her puppy, I honestly cannot guarantee that I would be getting that spot. They say that dogs are a man's best friend. Well, at least they say that in a lot of Western countries. But most of us know that dogs, even chihuahuas, are descended from wolves. The grey wolf, to be exact. How did this happen? More importantly, why did we start playing with wolves? Because let me tell you, if I were a cavewoman facing a pack of growling wolves, best friend wouldn't be the first thing on my mind. And yet, here we are. So why do we love dogs? We talk to geneticist Professor Gregor Larson and the owner of Henry, the Blue Peter dog. But let's start by delving into the anthropologist's notebook. Because of the way that we talk about them in the West, it is easy to think that everybody loves dogs. But while finding dogs useful is universal globally, loving them, well, not so much. See, I was raised within the Muslim tradition, and like many cultures globally, it's not common to see them being kept as pets. This is because most schools of Islamic theology state that the saliva of a dog is impure and invalidates the ablution that is necessary for prayer five times a day. As a result, many avoid dogs. So the love of dogs has a heavy cultural component. But dogs have been a part of our story for an incredibly long time. They are depicted in cave and rock art and footsteps of a young child and what looks like a dog dating to 26,000 years ago were found near the famous Chauvet cave. And they are a part of our story because of how useful they are. From the mundane everyday hunting and guarding to the epic stories of life-saving dogs, stories like this make people want them as pets. In the West, this is so entrenched that Blue Peter, the flagship BBC kids show, has a pet dog. His name is Henry, and his owner, Lauren Howell, told me all about him.
Henry is the 10th Blue Peter pet over its 66 years of the show. And he is also our little family dog. He's our family pet too.
So how do people react to Henry on set?
Oh, everyone absolutely loves him. From the kids who come in from the local schools, like it usually starts with them coming through the doors of the set and one of them will say, "Oh, there's Henry," and they'll all flock to him and give him cuddles and strokes. Sometimes, though, there's celebrity guests who come in, and I think one of them that was quite recent was the WWE wrestler Cody Rhodes came in, and you can imagine so many people were there and wanting to meet him, and I promise you, he walked through that door and he made a beeline straight to Henry and started taking selfies with him. So he was the star of the show, like, you know, with the kids, with guests, and the crew, of course, love him. He's just a little staple in that family. For us personally, as a family, he is just our little, he's like a little brother in a way, and he means so much to us.
Henry is clearly an essential part of Lauren's family, and regardless of whether we love them or not, dogs have had a special relationship with us for a very, very long time. In fact, it's so special because it was also a first for our species. Going back in time, we did this thing called domestication. We tamed things that were once wild. Agriculture, which started around 10,000 years ago, is domestication. Whether it be wheat or cows, we are the only species to do this, to domesticate the world around us for our own game. But wolves into dogs was even earlier. In fact, they were the very first species, animal or plant, to be domesticated, long, long before the advent of agriculture. But Oxford professor Gregor Larsen, a don of ancient dog DNA, challenged me on the traditional view. He thinks the evolution of wolves to dogs was more of a chance encounter.
So the reason I call it a relationship is because I think it's far more valuable to think about it as any relationship. Someone very close to you, a spouse, a husband, wife, whatever. Nobody necessarily chooses the other person. So therefore, to say that we domesticated wolves gives it an intentionality that most relationships in our lives do not have. And therefore, for us to ascribe that makes it sound like we knew what we were doing, we had a plan, and we were smart about it. And we went out and we were like, you know what? In this wolf, 20,000 years ago, I can see a chihuahua. And all we have to do is tinker with it enough, and then we can get something to put in our handbags and call it something.
Can we speculate about what we were both doing that was useful to each other?
I think there's probably an overall better efficiency together, right? So I think we probably made better hunting partners together. I think that we probably benefited because if those wolves saw us as theirs, they're acting as sentries, which makes everything a bit safer. And from the wolf perspective, there might be a greater regularity of a food supply. So there would certainly have been mutual benefits sufficient enough to sustain the relationship, at which point it becomes now you're reliant upon them. And even in times of trouble when you probably wouldn't want them around, now you have to take care of them or you don't. We see there's all kinds of great examples where people who were pursuing life ways involving hunting would venerate those dogs to such a degree that they're burying them in graves as though they're people with grave goods that are equivalent to high-ranking people within that society. And that's happening in Japan, it's happening in Scandinavia, it's happening in the southeast corner of the US. So this is a regular feature happening independently where people are absolutely having super tight relationships with these dogs as essential to their life way. And then when those populations start pursuing something else, like say agriculture, we find dogs on those sites, but they're not buried. We find their bones, we find cut marks, and we find a whole bunch of other ways in which people were basically disabused of that. And they're like, we don't need you anymore. We're kicking you to the curb.
Okay, that is fascinating. Because humans, we don't tend to bury something. We definitely don't tend to bury something with grave goods unless we highly regard them. But just to know that once we start developing agriculture and we're not hunting as much, that relationship changes and you're suddenly not seeing the burying of these dogs that's mind-boggling.
But then it does change again, because every time we have a job to do, a dog will put its paw up and go, yeah, you know what, we got it, don't worry about it, we'll figure that out. Because again, you wouldn't domesticate a dog, again, putting that in that kind of very proactive, intentional, you wouldn't say, we see a wolf there, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to kind of play with it for a little bit, and 20,000 years from now, somebody coming through an airport is going to have their bag sniffed and somebody's going to realize that there's some drugs in it. Or an epileptic person is going to be warned by this dog that a seizure is coming. No. These are all things that the dogs have acquired through that relationship with us. And every time we've got a job, a dog will do it. New jobs pop up and dogs will be like, yeah, totally, gotcha. I can deliver things. If you want us to point, we can do that. You want us to sniff stuff? Absolutely. We're all over it. In a way that no other domestic animal is doing even a 10% of those jobs.
It's interesting that you're basically arguing that dogs seem to just always know when to be around. And I see it especially because our relationship with dogs in the very modern era has changed. It's incredibly common now to see people walking around with dogs and treating dogs to incredibly good food, letting the dogs sleep in their beds. And part of me does wonder, the birth rates have gone down. Am I speculating too much by asking if some of these dogs are in lieu of children, if that's the role that they're taking? Remember when we were kids, dogs were outside a lot of the time. It wouldn't be unusual to have a dog sleep outside.
Oh, sure. And that's still true of a lot of people, where they're working dogs, right? Yeah. Or they're separate from the family. And there has been a long history of this. A colleague of mine, Eric Torini in Newcastle, did this amazing study where he looked at headstones of dog burials in a pet cemetery starting from about 1880 to the present. And in the 19th century, it was, as you described, very common for people to see dogs in this light, where you have one or more, but they are outside, they're working, they are certainly not part of your family. And at the time, what you're taught when you go to church is that humans go to heaven, but your animals, not so much. There's no doggy heaven, and they certainly wouldn't be anywhere near any human heaven. So the headstones for a first little while, make no reference to an afterlife at all. Then what you start to see in the first couple decades of the 20th century is people making an allusion to it and kind of like, well, we hope to, kind of in defiance of the prevailing wisdom of the church at the time, which is like, you cannot say that you are going to see your dog in heaven. Yes, you can experience grief for the loss of this animal, but it's an animal. It's not a member of your family. So people are making reference to this. And then the dam bursts and you get up to modern age where people are like, screw it. I'm going to see Fido in heaven, God damn it. You know, they just like, they go full on in and they expect now that these are not just child surrogates. They are actual members of the family.
Let's take some of that apart. I do wonder if there are any studies showing why when we see a puppy, we just want to cuddle it and look after it.
Yeah.
So beyond all the logical stuff that you're giving me, right? Of course, now.
So there is a brilliant study that looked at dog puppies and ranked them by cuteness depending on how many weeks old they were, because there is this issue between dogs and wolves. If you are a wolf, both parents will look after the puppies into their second year. Dogs are really only cared for by the mother, and the mothers will generally get rid of them between like 8 and 12 weeks. They're like, she's like, nope, I'm out, you're done. So again, a way in which dogs and wolves are radically, radically different. So the hypothesis of this study was, do dog puppies achieve maximal cuteness right at that point where they are being abandoned by their mothers, thereby allowing the care to be continued not by the dog mother, but by someone who might come and see them on a street and go, I must now take you home because you look just like my favorite Disney dog, right? And so they got a couple dozen people, and they made these really nice black and white images of three different breeds and a whole series of dog puppies from like 1 week up to a couple dozen weeks. Put them in random order, and they simply asked people to rank them on a cuteness of 1 to 10. And they did, within the three different breeds, there was a little variability, but it was usually around about 8 weeks when dog puppies achieved maximal cuteness, which people said, yeah, that's the one that is just high. After that, it's kind of a little bit older, teenage-y, ugh. And before that, it's an infant, gross. I don't want to have anything to do with it. So it's right in that critical period where dogs are most vulnerable from being abandoned by their mother and now completely incapable of surviving on their own, that they then are now the most cute to humans, who are likely to pick up the slack and take them home and start feeding them.
I think sometimes the evolution is just pure poetry. Modern dogs, unlike wolves, are biologically tuned to be irresistibly cute to us at exactly the age that dog mothers leave pups to fend for themselves. So it's no accident that so many of us have a longing for a cute puppy in our lives. Evolution, it turns out, works in manipulative ways. I asked Lauren what she made of Henry's wolf forefathers and mothers.
It's crazy to think, isn't it, how Henry's ancestors could be quite scary.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really good perspective on it. Like, how lucky are we to end up having such a lovely companion and have them as pets as well, and actually have them within our homes? Like, I can't imagine it being any other way, though. Like, I can't imagine it us not having dogs.
So the love of dogs has a heavy cultural component. Henry is clearly loved. Lucy, my cousin's dog, is loved by my cousin. But my grandmother wouldn't understand that love of Lucy as a pet. However, if Lucy was in Yemen, where our family originally come from, and stayed outside as a guard dog and did a good job, which, if you've ever met Lucy, does involve suspending reality, then I reckon our grandmother would really appreciate her, even love the work that she does. So we might have started off loving what dogs did for us, but now some of us are just in love with them. Why Do We Do That is a BBC Studios audio production for BBC Radio 4. This episode was presented by me, Ella Alshamahi, and produced by Emily Bird, with additional production from Olivia Jani and Ben Hughes. If you've enjoyed Why Do We Love Dogs, then remember there's more in-depth science on how, when, and where the first dogs evolved on BBC Sounds in the bonus episode More Dogs with Gregor Larson. Find that episode and more on BBC Sounds. Just search Why Do We Do That? Be a doll and subscribe, and have push notifications turned on. That way you won't miss Why We Go to the Pub, Blush and Fall for the Bad Boy, though not always in that order.
Nature.
Nature back.
Back. Back.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Nature Bang.
I'm Becky Ripley.
I'm Emily Knight.
And in this series from BBC Radio 4, we look to the natural world to answer some of life's big questions.
Like, how can a brainless slime mold help us solve complex mapping problems?
And what can an octopus teach us about the relationship between mind and body?
It really stretches your understanding of consciousness.
With the help of evolutionary biologists.
I'm actually always very comfortable comparing us to other species.
Philosophers.
You never really know what it could be like to be another creature.
And spongeologists. Is that your job title? Are you a spongeologist?
Well, I am in certain spheres.
It's science meets storytelling.
With a philosophical twist.
It really gets to the heart of free will and what it means to be you.
So if you want to find out more about yourself
via cockatoos that dance, frogs that freeze, and single-cell amoebas that design border policies,
subscribe to Nature Bang from BBC Radio 4, available on BBC Sounds.